You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. Only double. Clap your hands.
Good morning, everyone. It is Wednesday, the 2nd of April. You're listening to Wednesday Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 a.m. Thank you to Earth Matters, which is 3CR's national program for social justice and environment issues. Coming from Castlemaine, I think it was, for the Women's Climate Congress there, which I didn't manage to get down to, but really wish I had. We've got me in the studio, Sonia.
Nita, good morning, listeners.
And Jesse, good morning, everyone. Happy Wednesday.
And it's feeling more wintry outside at last.
Yes, but I still saw many, many dedicated exercise fanatics running around. Amazing. Always mind-blowing, actually.
Yeah, but it does come off the back of the warmest March in Australia's recorded history.
I see.
With 0.4 degrees higher than the last record-breaking March, which was just in 2019.
Right.
So that's a massive jump in terms of the hottest temperature.
Mm.
So thank you for the Women's Climate Congress for doing excellent work on trying to combat the changing catastrophic climate.
Yes,
indeed.
It has definitely felt warmer this March, definitely.
Yeah. Right, what have we got on the show today?
So today we're starting off with a clip from Jan Bartlett's excellent Tuesday Home Time program, where Jan interviews a member of the Syrian Alawite community here in Melbourne. And their name is Syria. Sorry, their name is Lily Syria. And they'll be, discussing the situation for Alawite community here in Melbourne, but of course, in light of current events happening in Syria, and providing their perspective. Following that, we'll have another part of the discussion that I had with the incredible Sasha Gillies-Lakakis, who listeners might be familiar with as someone who's an expert on all things Latin America, as they also co-host the Latin American Update and the Unitarian Half Hour. So in this section, or this part of the interview, we're finally into the socialist project of Cuba and some of the challenges that came about when implementing. And then after that, we've got a clip from
Zina Kumpston, who is a Barkanji woman with Afghan, English and Irish heritage. Zina currently resides in Narm, and she will be speaking to us about food sovereignty and indigenous, what food sovereignty means for indigenous people living on this continent.
And we will be wrapping up the show with an interview with David Gland, who is an activist with the Refugee Action Collective, talking to us about the Palm Sunday rally and also the pre-election rally that they will be having in Brunswick on Saturday. And just generally talking about some of the issues and activism that's happening around refugee rights.
Yes, the election.
Yes. Okay. I noticed on a politician's Twitter feed yesterday, the comments were all calling for zero immigration and an abandonment of net zero. I don't think I need to say what sort of party this was, but it's like, really? You've got your zeros the wrong way around.
Yeah. And I don't know. I don't know if that was that kind of rhetoric, or, you know, that calling for those kinds of things was... could have passed previous election. I'm not sure.
I don't know. I mean, I think that either of those policies is just suicidal in terms of Australia's future. But shall we go on to the news headlines?
Yes, we'll head to news headlines, and we'll be back in a second once I find the news headlines button. Bear with us. Here we go.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Now, one, two, nitty-gritty. Now, yeah, boom, nitty-gritty.
Today is Wednesday, the 2nd of April, 2025, and these are the new headlines. First from Greenpeace, a Moreton County jury of nine reached a verdict in Energy Transfer's meritless lawsuit against Greenpeace entities in the US. That's Greenpeace Incorporated and Greenpeace Fund and Greenpeace International, finding the entities liable for more than $600 million, which equates to $1 billion Australian dollars, on the 19th of March. Big oil bullies around the world will continue to try to silence free speech and peaceful protest, but the fight against Energy Transfer's meritless slap lawsuit is not over. This case should alarm everyone, no matter what their political inclinations, said Sushma Raman, the interim executive director of Greenpeace Incorporated, Greenpeace Fund. Quote, it's part of a renewed push by corporations to weaponize our courts to silence dissent. We should all be concerned about the future of the First Amendment and lawsuits like this aimed at destroying our rights to peaceful protest and free speech. These rights are critical for any work towards ensuring justice, and that's why we'll continue fighting back together in solidarity. While big oil bullies can try to stop a single group, they can't stop a movement. We're witnessing a disastrous return to the reckless behavior that fuels the climate crisis, deepened environmental racism, and put fossil fuel profits over public health and a livable planet. The previous Trump administration spent 4 years dismantling protections for clean air, water, and indigenous sovereignty, and now, along with its allies wants to finish the job by silencing protest. We will not back down. We will not be silenced, said Mads Christensen, Greenpeace International Executive Director. In this case, Energy Transfer has maintained their entirely false claims that Greenpeace organized the hashtag NoDAPL resistance at Standing Rock, an allegation rooted in racism in its erasure of indigenous leadership in North Dakota. Open quote. What we saw over these 3 weeks was Energy Transfer's blatant disregard for the voices of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, said Deepa Padmanha, senior legal counsel of Greenpeace USA. And while they also try to distort the truth about Greenpeace's role in the protests, we instead reaffirmed our unwavering commitment to nonviolence in every action we take. To be clear, Greenpeace's story is not the story of Standing Rock. Our story is how an organization like Greenpeace USA can support critical fights to protect communities most impacted by the climate crisis, as well as continued attacks on Indigenous sovereignty. This lawsuit is one of the largest strategic lawsuits against public participation, known as SLAPP, SLAP, cases ever filed. These are meritless lawsuits meant to silence or bankrupt opponents, which is why most US states and several countries have put legal protections in place to protect advocates. But in North Dakota and 15 other states, no anti-SLAP statutes exist.
And a content warning for this next piece. It is quite strong, and if you have small people there, you might want to just turn off for a couple of minutes. Haaretz, an Israeli newspaper, has reported that every IOF unit keeps a human shield, a sub-army of Palestinian slaves who are forced to enter houses in Gaza to make sure there are, and quote, no terrorists or explosives. News which comes as other news spreads, though largely not in Western media, of 15 Red Crescent medics who were executed by the IOF, and as Netanyahu has repeated the genocidal plan to enforce the so-called voluntary migration of people out of Gaza, also as US and German universities doubled down on students speaking out on the genocide, and the University of Sydney here in a so-called Australia hosts Zionist speakers. All this while a Palestinian doctor posts on Twitter about his grief that instead of spending the first day of Eid celebrating, he was cutting dead children out of their new clothes.
Amnesty International has released a statement on a devastating earthquake in Myanmar, responding to reports of wide-scale damage from a 7.7 magnitude earthquake reported in central and other parts of Myanmar. Amnesty International's Myanmar researcher Joe Freeman said, "This earthquake could not come at a worse time for Myanmar. More than 3 million people remain internally displaced from armed conflict that has raged since the 2021 military coup. Over a third of the population will need humanitarian assistance this year. At the same time, the impacts of US aid cuts on humanitarian services in the country are just starting to bite." Open quote. "In a country where the military has banned many media outlets and internet access is restricted, we may not have a clear picture of the extent of damage and loss for some time. That there appear to be more images and information coming out of Thailand than the epicenter in Myanmar is a startling reminder of the military's crushing of press freedom since the 2021 coup. Central Myanmar, which is believed to be the epicenter of the earthquake, has been ravaged by military airstrikes and clashes between resistance groups and the military. Myanmar's military has a long-standing practice of denying aid to areas where groups who resist it are active. It must immediately allow unimpeded access to all humanitarian organizations and remove administrative barriers delaying needs and assessments. All parties to the armed conflict should be prioritizing the needs of civilians whose lives have been upended in this disaster and ensuring they have unfettered access to aid. Human rights must be at the center of all relief efforts, and there must be no discrimination in aid provision. Amnesty International is calling particularly for the protection of those with specific needs, including children, older people, people with disabilities, and women and girls in vulnerable situations." The background to this is that a 7.7 magnitude earthquake hit Myanmar at around 1:20 p.m. on the 28th of March. It was recorded in Myanmar's Saigon region, but initial reports indicate widespread damage in Myanmar's second largest city, Mandalay, and the capital, Naypyidaw, with homes, religious sites, and cultural property among the impacted sites. Tremors were also felt across the border in Thailand, in Bangkok, and in Chiang Mai. At least 10,000 people appear dead.
And that's it from the news headlines for today. You're listening to Wednesday Breakfast on the 2nd of April on 8:55 a.m, streaming live on 3cr.org.au or coming to you from the Community Radio Listen app. Shall we go to a community announcement?
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
And you're listening to 3CR Wednesday Breakfast. It's 13 minutes past 7, 2nd of April 2025. We'll head to a section of Jan Bartlett's excellent Tuesday Home Time program from last week. This was where Jan spoke with Lily, who is a member of Melbourne's Alawite community from Syria. And Lily speaks about the community's response here in Melbourne and, of course, in Syria about the current events in Syria, and provides a really clear analysis. Let's have a listen.
In recent weeks, Syria has been wracked by the worst violence the country has seen since the fall of the government of Assad last December. And the main targets were cities and villages along Syria's Mediterranean coast, where members of the minority Alawite sect live. Today I'm speaking with a member of the Alawite community here in Australia, Lily, for an understanding of what is happening in Syria today and why. Lily, before we analyse what is happening in Syria to your people, can you talk to me about the history of the Alawite communities in Syria and beyond in Lebanon and other areas of the Middle East?
Well, at the moment, we're a small community, mainly in Syria and Lebanon and the diaspora. We do have a long history of being persecuted in every era, since the beginning of our existence. Most recently, you know, the Ottoman Empire, there were massacres of Alawites there, and many fled to the mountains as a result. And so we do get labelled as mountain people these days, but it's because of the history of persecution that we have fled to mountains to live. We're kind of outsiders in a way. We're very moderate, secular, peace-loving. There's an esoteric or internal belief system as well, and I guess we're seen as heretics by the rest of the Islamic world. And so we've been targeted for a very, very long time. So as I said, the Ottoman era, we were massacred. There's a very famous massacre in Aleppo in what's now called Martyrs Square. And, you know, my ancestors witnessed that. And, you know, we were told that the blood filled streets and it was up to your knees, bodies were piled up. And that was, you know, the most recent sort of large massacre of Alawites. There are many Alawites in Australia, some in Canada, some in the US, some in South America, some still in Turkey, some in Albania, but a lot of, because of the constant massacres and persecution, many converted to Christianity or other types of Islam. My family know their history very well, being told that there were Alawites in Yemen, in Jordan, Morocco, Egypt. So they were spread out a lot more previously, but in modern history, we're in the western mountain plains of Syria and the northern part of Lebanon.
What's so different about your position of Islam that leads to all that persecution?
Well, it all starts at the end of, towards the end of Muhammad's, the peace be upon him, the prophet's life, where who was going to be the successor? Was it going to be, you know, his cousin and best friend and son-in-law? Basically, that person was, we call that person Imam Ali. Or was it going to be the friendship group that he had? And so the biggest difference is that who you believed was the rightful caliphate or the successor of Muhammad. That's where the splits start to occur. So we're very similar to Shiite Islam in that we believe that the Prophet's family are the rightful successors to that, and we believe that the Prophet's descendants, so his family, are an example to humanity on how to behave and how to conduct ourselves. And there's a very famous quote from Imam Ali which states there are two types of people in the world, people who are brothers in your faith and people who are equals in humanity. So you can see there that it's a very tolerant, very secular religion. We've never tried to forcefully convert anybody. There's no terrorism in our religion. In fact, it is a very peace-loving and very spiritual religion. Your goal is enlightenment. You know, I'm sure you're aware of other religions that, you know, like Buddhism. It's all about, you know, a proper Muslim is somebody who doesn't harm anybody. And that's our view. And I guess that's the main difference between us and other sects is really essentially who the successor is.
So what you've just been saying is that the story we're being told is that the Alawites are being targeted because of their connections to the Bashar al-Assad regime. So you've pointed out that that's not true at all. This has been going on for a long, long time.
Long, long time. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's unfair to collectively punish a religious group based on the actions of a member of that group. Now, in terms of the Assad rule, the only benefit that we got as Alawites during his period of rule, even when we look at that, it's not because we had preferential treatment, but it was because of the secular ideology of the Ba'athist Socialist Party. It's a secular party, which means that you're not treated differently based on your religion. And that's what gave us protection. But in terms of, you know, were we treated preferentially? Well, no, as a community, definitely not. We didn't even have a religious council, you know, that gave advice to the government or anything like that, whereas all the other minorities did. We weren't allowed to hold any other jobs other than civil service jobs. So, you know, enterprise like owning factories and big business, we weren't given those opportunities. In fact, some of the poorest people in Syria are the Alawites. You know, I look at my auntie, for example, who lives in Latakia. When I visited her the last time, her shower was a bucket and a tap. She invited us over for dinner and there was about six of us sharing half a chicken and maybe half a loaf of bread. And when I used to ask her, what would you like me to bring you from Australia, she'd say to me, Panadol. So you can see there that, you know, these aren't people who are, you know, lavishing in riches and special treatment. Of course, there would have been some families in the inner circle that coincidentally were Alawite and benefiting. But there were also Sunnis and Christians and all different sects. So I find it really unfair to scapegoat Alawites for the wrongdoings of the Assad government.
It's quite obvious massacres are taking place in the west of Syria now. It started, this latest massacres started in 2011, 2012. Is that correct as you see it?
Yes, that's right.
Can you talk about that time and what was happening in 2011, 2012?
Yeah, definitely. The last time I visited Syria was actually in 2010 in April, so literally a year before all of this started. Now, at the beginnings of 2011, you know, in the first week, people thought that, you know, this is a revolution, let's go out and protest in support, we want democracy. And in that first week, a family friend of ours, a farmer, was taking his goods from farm to the city to sell, and he was stabbed to death in the square in the city simply for being Alawite. Now, when we heard that, we thought, hang on, this isn't a revolution. What's going on here? And I guess many Syrians realised as things progressed that this wasn't a proper revolution. Like, for example, when the Free Syria Army, which was the first rebel group to be formed, when they cheered when the US Navy ships arrived, it was a little bit strange. People then realised that, you know, what's going on here? And there was the accusation that the government forces were shooting at innocent civilians that were protesting. But the other side of that were that there were people who were armed in the crowd causing strife and shooting at police. They then hijacked a police station, stole the weapons, and these were all the groups that were calling themselves Free Syria Army at that point. So it became very clear pretty quickly that this wasn't an organic, proper revolution. And so I feel like the reason why Syria has held on this long is because of the patriotism of Syrians and Syrians knowing that this isn't a true revolution.
But it must have been a very hard years from 2012 to 2024 for the people in many areas of Syria, particularly your people's area.
Yeah. Well, my stepmom's family, they come from a place called Hama. And my stepmom has lost about 30 to 40 family members in the last 10 years. All of her nieces are widows. One mum lost all her sons and her husband. And the last son died with the husband. He was coming home after serving in the army, as they do, because that's their only income. They're the poor. And he rang his parents and said, look, I'm afraid because the road I have to go on is a road that's known to have terrorists. His dad said, I'll come and pick you up. The mum got a call saying, come pick up your son and husband in garbage bags. They chopped them up into pieces.
And that wouldn't be an unusual situation for many other people.
No, no, it wasn't. It wasn't. And, you know, people say that these people were fighting for the Assad government. They were fighting for their families. They were fighting for their neighbours. They were fighting for their way of life. It's pretty clear when you read more into it who these groups are. We're talking about Al-Qaeda, who, you know, the US claims to fight, you know, in Afghanistan. We're talking about ISIS. We're talking about Al-Nusra. These are all extremist terrorist organisations. And Syrians were protecting their nation. It's quite, you know, hurtful to refer to these people as remnants of Assad and loyalists to Assad. To be honest, they're just protecting their family and their way of life. And even in saying that, when on December 8th, many, many people from the Alawite community embraced the change in government, reached out to the new government and said, you know, we're happy to support you. Please, you know, include us in what you do. And they had no response back. And in fact, some of those leaders that reached out are now have now been, you know, killed. So I think, as I said, Syrians were fighting for their nation and for their way of life. And the other thing to note is that Alawites are a very small minority, like 10% Syria's population. The majority is Sunni Muslim. And then there are some other minorities like Shiites, Druze, Christians. They were all fighting in the army. So why isn't anybody, like, why aren't the majority being equally punished? Why have, you know, Alawites been scapegoated? Is it just because we share the same religion as those who were in power? There are many in the Alawite community who opposed Bashar al-Assad. You know, even his own cousin was opposition. So to sit there and state that, oh, you know, we're motivated by our loyalty to Assad. We existed before Assad and will exist after Assad. So it's really unfair to, you know, scapegoating an entire community.
Have you been able to keep in touch with members of your family there since the 8th of December?
Most of them have left. So a lot of people are displaced. Many have gone across the border to Lebanon, but some are still there because it's unsafe to cross. There were a couple of days there where there were people had heard the checkpoints weren't manned across the border, and so a lot of people tried to escape, and then journalists covered it, and then it brought light to it, and so now anybody that's trying to cross is getting shot. I have two aunties that I am not in contact with and don't know their whereabouts. One is in Damascus. The other one is in a care facility. She's, mentally disabled, so she's in a care facility. And, yeah, I have absolutely no idea what's happened to her. Another aunt has crossed over to Lebanon. Her kids are with her, which is good. But a lot of people are displaced. There's several families living in one place. There's a shortage of food. People have left with just the clothes on their back. It's a very dire situation. There are still some people, you know, relatives, extended family in Syria, and they're too scared to leave their homes. A lot of them are running out of food. They need money. There's, you know, virtually no way to send them support. I'm in touch with hundreds of other families, Alawite families in Australia that have got relatives overseas, and they're all, you know, receiving harrowing messages from their relatives, you know, please help us. And we really feel really helpless and powerless. We don't know how to help them.
What do you know of the situation in Lebanon at the moment?
We have people in Lebanon, family members and friends, and other volunteers. There's a group of about 200 volunteers who are saying there's about 14,000 Syrians that have been displaced in Lebanon, with about 90% of them in the Alawite area, which is called Jabal Mahsen, which is, you know, an Alawite area in Lebanon. We've heard that many of them have just come with the clothes that they're wearing, and some of them have had to leave their men behind. For example, the men were rounded up and the women were allowed to leave. And so there's people that have been separated. There are families who were in their homes and then heard that the HTS and HTS-affiliated militants were coming towards their town. And so the men and even the entire families have fled in different directions, and they don't know where the other person is.
there are people who they've got no money, they're poor as it is, and even in the Alawites in Lebanon, they're also known to be poor. So it's the poor helping the poor, and we've heard that there's no UNHCR in Lebanon anymore, so people have nowhere to register themselves. It's all a bit chaotic, and it's difficult to know how we can help them other than, you know, getting in contact with our families and sending our families money to buy food and clothing and, you know, help them take people into their homes.
Now, HTS, who are run by Jelani,
yep,
they're still registered as a terrorist organisation by the West. A bit more hypocrisy we see here.
That's right. That's right. I mean, there is a lot of hypocrisy. You know, the regime change narrative has been going on for over 10 years on the basis that this is a dictator, we want a democracy, yet Jelani is a self-appointed president of Syria. How is that democracy? And he stated, we're not going to have elections for another 3 to 4 years, if that ever happens, who knows? And this same person, you know, you look at his resume, he's ex-ISIS, he's ex-Al-Qaeda, he's ex-Al-Nusra Front, you know, he was involved in terrorist acts. He is a listed terrorist. You know, the US has recently, I think the US has taken him off the terrorist list. And this person is somehow fit to rule a country of 23 million people. Very hypocritical, and I do believe that the West and NATO, well, Turkey in particular from the NATO nations, you know, has backed him, and for their own reasons. And it's very strange to think that, you know, the US were after Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. That was their reason for being in Afghanistan. Yet this ex-Al-Qaeda leader is now president of Syria, and he's having all these meetings with the EU and the US and Qatar and all these countries like he's just a normal person. I feel like he's being whitewashed. You know, one moment he's this man in this traditional Arab clothing, and the next minute he's wearing a designer suit and designer shoes, you know, in the hopes that we will embrace him as a legitimate leader.
Do you know of other communities in Syria who are being targeted as well?
Yes, there are. I mean, you know, in Banias, which is a town in Syria, the numbers coming out of there were roughly about 3,000 killed. The militants killed not just Alawites, but Sunni Muslims and Christians who were sheltering Alawites. Feels a little bit yuck to refer to people by their religion, but I'm doing it just for clarity. But yes, there have been minorities killed and persecuted as well. And there's also, you know, other minorities other than Alawites. There's Ismailis, there's Druze. You know, there are a lot of different minorities in Syria. And Syria as a society is very diverse. You know, in the past, you could have someone, you know, completely, a woman fully covered from head to toe with just eyes appearing, and a woman walking down the same street in a miniskirt. And that was normal society. So Syria as a society is very diverse, and there are lots of minorities. There's lots of, you know, Armenian Christians, there's Orthodox Christians, there's Maronites, there's Melkites, there's lots of different types of Christian groups. When we look at Christianity, a lot of these Christian groups were born out of Syria. You know, there are lots of different minorities in Syria, and yes, they are being persecuted, and these militants have said that, you know, after we, you know, kill all the Alawites, then we're coming to the other minorities. So they're in fear as well.
You said that it's very difficult for you and your families here in Australia to send support. Is there any support coming from neighbouring countries?
No, there's no support. There's zero support. I mean, we're not even hearing about this in mainstream media, in mainstream Western media. Who wants to help the Alawites? Well, we're not allied with anybody. At the moment, there are about 8,000 Alawites sheltering in a Russian airbase in Syria. But I suppose if you want to call that help, that's some help. But there's really no one coming to our aid. Lebanon, during this period of the war in Syria, they've had a lot of Syrian refugees come, and they're like, well, we want the Syrians to go back. The majority don't want them there. Where are we going to go? You know, there's literally no one that we're allied with that's coming to save us.
Well, that's all I have. Lily, is there any final words you'd like to put to the people who are listening today?
Well, I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about my community and the events in Syria. I really appreciate that, given, you know, there hasn't been any sort of mainstream media coverage. And I want to let people know that the Alawite community and other minority communities in Syria, they deserve to live. All they want is just to live. That's all they're asking for. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Lily, a member of the Alawite community here in Melbourne.
And you're back with Wednesday Breakfast. It's 7:35 exactly a.m. We just heard a clip from Jan Bartlett's Tuesday Home Time program, which runs every Tuesday, 4 to 6 p.m. And Jan was speaking with a member of the Alawite community here in Melbourne, Naam, about the current situation for Alawites and other minorities living in Syria. Now we'll head to a second last part of the conversation that I had with Sasha Gillies-Lakakis. Sasha is a co-host of the Latin American Update and Unitarian Half Hour programs here on 3CR. Sasha is an incredible, knowledgeable mind and person on all things Latin America and beyond. And we're picking up the conversation on Cuba, where we've gone through the whole kind of history from the independence movements and from the monarchy. And last week we began the modern socialist project, of course, with Fidel Castro and Che Guevara. And now that socialist project is going fully and complete. And so we're going to hear how that played out and the challenges as well.
I see that as a similar struggles playing out as these socialist experiments continue in countries like China, for example, where mm-hmm. how do you keep the young people, the new generations, focused and on board with what the previous generation had fought so hard for in the revolutionary wars, because obviously they haven't had those experiences, and things have changed a lot since. And there's so many external pressures and so many external interests, and so it's a big, I see that as the next phase of the challenge in some of these projects that that is new. It's a new challenge, it's a new thing that I don't think has really existed before, so it's a really important part of this these experiments.
Absolutely. And I'll just say that it's, as you say, there's challenges because it's, you know, these countries are developing socialism and their unique systems as we speak. But that also means there's a lot of opportunities. And what I will say now, you know, I mentioned that eventually Asian countries have shown more interest in Cuba, and this has been very critical for the revolution, not only, you know, in terms of, you know, physical, practical, pragmatic sort of issues, you know, looking at importing, finding food. For example, a lot of Cuba's rice now is sent to them by Vietnam, and a lot of it is in donation form. They don't pay for it. But, you know, even if we're looking at the economic theory behind, you know, different sort of socialist models, Cuba is now showing a much greater interest in, for example, the Chinese system and the Vietnamese system, and a lot of their more recent reforms that have empowered, you know, the small private sector, you know, to try and get more foreign currency into the country, are largely inspired by those examples from Asia. So, you know, it is an exciting thing as well that, you know, that Cuba can not only look at the past, you know, and keep what was good about the Soviet model, because there was a lot that served Cuba well, but then also now implementing these more recent developments in economic theory that are coming from, for example, China, which has shown itself to be extremely successful economically. This is one of the biggest lies that has been perpetrated against Cuba, this idea that it's this sort of uncaring, detached dictatorship it's rigid, you know, that it's a product of a bygone era, when, you know, nothing is further from the truth. In fact, I will describe and explain the political system and the way that elections work, because there are regular, and very involved electoral processes in Cuba, much more regular and direct than we have in the Western world. And much more democratic as well, because there are multiple levels. Firstly, there are two electoral levels. There's the very local level, which is done at the level, again, of the neighborhood block, which are called circunscripciones in Cuba. So, you know, this will typically have, you know, could have 20 to 30 apartments in it. And each one of these individual blocks will hold local elections. And basically what is done is there are typically 2 to 3 meetings where people can nominate someone from their neighborhood block to run as a politician for local level councils. And by show of hands, you know, people either consent to that nomination or reject it. But, you know, most people that are put forward are generally, you know, hard workers, you know, people who've worked for their community because they are not paid. So, you know, you're not going to get someone being nominated because they want to make money off a political post. They are not paid, with the exception of, you know, the national executive in the country and governors. Politicians are not paid in Cuba. This is an additional, compromise that you make, an additional obligation you make on top of your regular work. So you have these local elections. Once people have been nominated, typically it's 2 or 3 people, but it has varied. Sometimes there have been up to 10 within certain neighborhood blocks, sometimes as few as 2. There always has to be at least 2. And then votes are held, you know, in this neighborhood in some sort of community center. And this is essentially how 1 to 2 people are elected from each of these neighborhood blocks, depending on demographics. And these make up the local councils in Cuba, which are basically tasked with very, very local level, you know, complaints, issues relating to, for example, sewerage or, you know, roads. They're essentially like, you know, I guess the equivalent of our council, except the council here is much more detached from everyday people, you know, and generally quite unresponsive. But, you know, these people, by and large, from what I can tell, there are exceptions, of course, but by and large, they do seem to be much more involved because, you know, they are going into this with a different mentality because they're not getting paid for it. They're going into this because they want to help their community or represent their community. And then at the national level, we have the National Assembly of People's Power, which is essentially the Congress or the, you know, the parliament for Cuba. And there is, again, this is split in half. This is split in half. There are 600 members of the National Assembly from across the island, again, done by population. And basically, the voting is split into 2. So one half is elected by the people. So, you know, in general elections, then has to be approved by the assembly. And the other half is elected by what are called the mass organizations. So there's 5 mass organizations in Cuba, which are basically groups that are meant to represent the different interest groups in Cuba. So we have the CDRs, the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, which are very, very localized. Again, they're involved in this local electoral process, not so much at the national, but they're very, very local political groups. Again, they're a vehicle for sort of public discussion, you know, complaints, all of these sorts of things. And there's CDRs in every neighborhood in Cuba. So 94% of the population of Cuba belongs to the CDRs. It's not compulsory, but just out of virtue of it being, you know, a generally successful model, people do join the CDRs and they do get involved. So this is one of the interest groups. The other one is the National Federation of Cuban Farmers, which of course represents the rural areas. The Workers Central, this trade union federation that we spoke about earlier, that is another one. The Federation of Students, of Cuban Students, that's another one, normally from the university level, but they do also have a high school branch as well. And then the final one is the Federation of Cuban Women, which of course is concerned with promoting women's rights and women's issues in Cuba. So each of these 5 groups has its own internal election amongst its members to then elect the other half of the 600 people that are in the National Assembly of People's Power. So, you know, this idea is you know, basically the idea is that you will get a very even spread of people from, you know, different walks of life in Cuba, and that they will then be able to advocate for their, you know, their interest group, basically to ensure that everyone is represented basically as best as is possible. And then it's the job of this assembly together, these 600 people, to then elect the national leadership. So they will then elect the president, they will elect, you know, the governors and all of these other high-ranking political postings. So what you have essentially is from the ground up, this very, very involved local to national political system, electoral political system, where Cuban people are constantly able, you know, they're able to go to, you know, pretty regular community meetings to discuss candidates. And then when they do go...
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
To their elections, it is, you know, free and what's the word I'm looking for? Like, you know, hidden sort of suffrage. Like, you know, no one knows, you know, who you vote for. No one knows where your vote goes or who it's from. And, you know, this has generally proven to be a popular mechanism because, as I mentioned, all of these people are doing it for the country and for their communities generally, of course. You know, there might be rare cases, you know, where people do it to get clout or influence. I'm sure that's the case. But generally, you know, because none of them are paid, with the exception of the national leadership, you know, this does eliminate a lot of the potential for corruption. And the most significant thing is there is a recall system where if a community elects someone and they aren't happy with their performance, if by a simple majority that community votes to remove that person from politics, they are fired from that job. And then the new election is held. So, you know, there are a lot of checks and balances within the Cuban political system. And, you know, the electoral history of, you know, the post-revolutionary, you know, sort of socialist process, it shows that this is a popular model, that with the exception of the most recent elections, the participation in local and national elections did not dip below 90%. So you, every time you had 90% or plus of the Cuban electorate participating in these processes. The most recent one, which was in 2022, I believe, that one did dip down to about 70-75%, which is still much higher than you would get in most Western countries anyway. But, you know, it does speak to the fact that there's been a bit of disengagement because of, you know, the very difficult situation. But, you know, this shows that the model retains its legitimacy. And even when we have, for example, these very, very transformative changes, political changes, like the new constitution, like the new family code, you know, that introduced greater rights for, you know, the LGBTQ plus community, for the elderly as well, for children. You know, this involved literally hundreds of neighborhood meetings, you know, that were organized around the country for people to submit their recommendations. And every Cuban citizen was allowed to submit their own clauses for consideration in the constitution and their own complaints. And they received hundreds of thousands. The Cuban government received hundreds of thousands of, you know, of different clauses, suggested amendments, which goes to show that the Cubans are involved, that they're very involved and they are invested in this political system.
And that was the incredible Sasha Gillies-Lakakis, co-host of the Latin American Update and Unitarian Half Hour programs here on 3CR, talking to us about the current system of governance in Cuba. And that was following on from quite a long conversation that we've been having regarding the history of Cuba and the socialist revolution and the government. Currently now, that's kind of the point where we're up to now in the story is how is the project going and how is it actually working in regards for the citizens of Cuba and how do they engage with governance in their day-to-day lives. Now we'll be heading to another recording that we've done, and Nita will tell us a bit about it.
Next up, we will listen to a conversation about Indigenous food sovereignty in so-called Australia. This conversation takes place between Wednesday Breakfast presenter Zoe and Zena Kampston and was recorded for last week's episode of Accent of Women. Zena Kampston is a Barkanji woman with Afghan, English and Irish heritage. Zena works as an artist, writer, consultant and curator. She's passionate about plants and seeks out projects that empower community and country. Zena is also a member of the Birrarung Council and the curator of First Nations projects at In Place Artist Residencies. In 2024, Zena wrote the Yuruan Growing on Country Resource, a unique space to consider food sovereignty and cultural landscapes, fostering fertile conditions for social and environmental justice and change. She's the co-author of the highly popular book, Plants, Past, Present, Future, First Knowledge Series, and is a widely published essayist and regular public speaker. This is the first half of the conversation between Zoe and Zena, and we will play the second half next week. Have a listen.
Thank you so much, Zena, for your time. Could you please start off with Molly Hadfield's social justice oration?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I've got a big event coming up. I'm speaking with two other orators, artist Sheena Matheson and artist Nadine Christensen. And it's actually the Molly Hadfield Social Justice Oration is named after Molly Hadfield, who was an incredible woman who lived here in Nam, Melbourne. She died in 2012. I think she was around 90 years old when she died. And she spent her entire life fighting for peace and justice, especially for women. Yeah. And she's particularly concerned with issues of housing and social equity. So every year they have this oration, and this year it's on Wednesday, the 2nd of April at 6:30 p.m. until 8:30 p.m. at the Darabin Arts Centre, which is at 401 Bell Street in Preston. And each one of us will be presenting a talk where we will speak about some of the things that were close to Molly's heart, and also the work that each of us are doing, trying to, I guess, mirror and emulate really powerful women who've come before us who care a lot about the social fabric of the place that they live.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, great. Can you talk a little bit about your popular book, Plants, Past, Present, Future? How did you get this knowledge? What was the idea? Why plants are important for you?
So I wrote the book with two other people, Professor Leslie Head and Professor Michael Sean Fletcher, and Michael is an Aboriginal person like me. And it came as a result of many years of research at the University of Melbourne, where I used to work. And I was given the opportunity to write five chapters as part of that co-written book. And it's part of the First Knowledges series, which really looks at the ways in which, I guess, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's knowledge has been misrepresented and undervalued over time. So each of the books focuses on a different aspect of our knowledge and culture, and ours obviously focuses in on plants. And my interest in plants came when I was pregnant with my first son, who is now 12 years old. I just got really, really into gardening, and it became such an important part of my health and well-being. And the more that I got into gardening and the more that I started to learn about plants, the more that it brought me back to my own Aboriginal ancestry. I am Aboriginal, Irish, English, and also Afghani. So I'm really proud of all of my different ancestors that have come together to make me who I am. But I'm particularly interested in, I guess, my Aboriginal and Afghan ancestry because my mum was just such an important part of my life and the person that I am today. And she was Aboriginal, Afghan and Irish. And so I haven't grown up on my country. And in our culture as Aboriginal people, the way that we learn is through country. We learn through smelling, tasting, experiencing stories as we travel across our cultural landscapes, and usually through our interactions with our elders who hold knowledge in our community and pass it on to those who they see are you know, good people to really carry that knowledge through. Now, because I didn't grow up on my country, it's been difficult for me to learn in the way that I'm supposed to about our knowledge. And so I always kind of push back on the idea that some people try and really push, which is that I'm an expert on plants, because I absolutely am not. And from a cultural perspective, as an Aboriginal person, my knowledge of plants would be no more than that of a newborn baby. But I am very passionate, and I have learned as much as I possibly can. And I've had to learn a lot from books, but I've also spent a lot of time out on my country with other community members who are Barkindji like me. So we're from Western New South Wales.
Yeah.
And our lands are quite incredible in that we have been able to live on them for more than 50,000 years. And in fact, the oldest ritual burial in the world has been found on our country, which we also share with two other groups. So we know that we've been there for a very, very, very long time. And I, the more research I did and the more I was out on my country with my elders, I realized that for me, plants really have been the very reason that we have been able to stay on our country for the longest time imaginable. And I think that's so powerful, to be the oldest living culture in the world as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. It was no accident that this happened. And so often the stories that we're learning in school here in Australia, or so-called Australia, and the ways in which we are taught don't give proper recognition and proper respect to that knowledge and how it's been passed down over time orally. And the fact that our knowledge is scientific knowledge, it's not Indigenous science, it's just science. And so the more I've learned and the more I've seen that plants are really the whole reason why we've been able to stay on our country and live there for the longest time imaginable, I've just wanted more and more to share those stories. For example, when a country becomes, I guess you could call it contracting, so the water goes, and this happens all the time in Australia, most of the time the droughts that happen and the huge climatic events that we have are very much a result of climate change. But over time, we've always had droughts, but not to the extent that we have them now. And on my country, we have our lifeblood, which is the Barker, which is the Darling River. But we know from our oral histories and from archaeological evidence that the Barker, you know, its flows did vary over time, and there were regular periods of drought-like conditions, nowhere near as what we have bad now, which is very, very bad, and it's caused by water theft, improper agriculture, all sorts of government, I call it bastardry, things that the government is doing to really not respect the cultural landscape and waterways. But those contractions would happen, but our people never had to leave. And it's because of things like understanding technologies. So across Australia, we know that we're the first bread makers. And as soon as water and animals and country kind of becomes dry and animals go away, one thing that happens is that plants throw out seed. And so one of the reasons we've been able to stay on our country for a really long time is because we learned to grind seed using grindstone technologies. We shared those technologies across our very diverse communities across Australia and the Torres Strait Islands. And because we could make bread from the seed and also understand plants and how they were still giving us what we needed, even in those times of really severe climatic shifts, ice ages, all sorts of things, it was that ingenuity, that ability to adapt, which we still have today as a peoples, that allowed us to stay on our country. And a lot of people don't know these stories and haven't been exposed to the power of our knowledge systems. And that's something that I'm really passionate about, because I think that as a people, we might be able to regain our health and well-being if we are, over time, given the respect that we deserve to look after our cultural landscapes, have access to our country. But really importantly, something I'm passionate about is food sovereignty. And that basically means our right to be able to access, eat, and live with our ancestral food ways. And at the moment, we have a situation where many of us don't have access to our country because it has been colonized. And people often think of colonization as in the past, but colonization is very much in the here and now. We are still being very detrimentally affected on a daily basis by structural inequities that I'm sure many of your listeners would fully understand as people who, have been marginalized and have been forced onto other lands because of this type of situation in their own countries.
Cool, thank you. I wanted to talk to you about Yoruban growing on country resource. What is it about and why you decided to write about growing on country?
So the Yoruban Growing on Country resource is an online resource, and it was put together by a woman called Dominique Chen, who's a Gomeroi woman. So she's also from Western New South Wales, where my Aboriginal community is. And Dom has been doing a lot of work around food sovereignty over the years, but also as an artist, as a researcher, as a writer, she's been talking about the health and well-being of our communities related to our foodways. And Dom really was noticing that there wasn't enough resources around for people to be able to connect with our knowledge of country, understand food sovereignty, and also, I guess most importantly, be really good allies for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who, as I said, you know, we are still very much being detrimentally harmed by the ongoing harms of colonisation. And so really it was a resource that was made to empower people to educate themselves, to have a little bit of help along the way, to make their self-education ongoing, because it includes so many resources that people can go deeper into afterwards. But it's online because it was a way of getting it out to as many people as possible. And it is, you do have to pay for access, but Dom has been really careful through her company Yoruban to make sure that it's a sliding scale. So there's lots of different ways that you can pay, and some options are way cheaper than others. And for example, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander can access that resource for free if they wish to. So it's for our community, but it's also for the wider community, people who want to know a bit more about the history of Australia, the history of agriculture, how agriculture and colonisation have interacted in the past and continue to do so now, to deny the rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and to detrimentally affect our health. It goes into all sorts of different topics, but best of all, it actually includes quite a few different elders and community members who talk about their own work with plants and their own passion for our food ways and our health and well-being enacted through our ability to access our foods, which is something we're really working towards. And all of the proceeds from the Yoruban Growing on Country resource go to different projects around Australia that are led by First Nations communities that are to do with access to food and empowerment.
Could you please let our listener know about how they can get access to Yoruban?
If listeners want to know more about Yoruban and also the Growing on Country resource, they can go to yoruban.org.au, which is yuruwan.org.au, or you can just Google Growing on Country and hopefully you'll be able to find that course and look at the different scales that you can pay with. Community groups, we often try and do it the cheapest. So if you're part of a community group, it's great to write to the website and just explain your situation. If you can't find a pricing situation that will work for you, the most important thing, I think, for Dom in the way that she decided to put this together was that anyone who really wants to access it should be able to access it. Mm-hmm. And no one's making money from this resource, even though we're charging. Dom is making sure that that money is going to many different community members who are doing that work to empower our foodways.
Yes, thank you. When you say colonization has changed agriculture, could you please explain a little bit?
So agriculture and colonization go hand in hand in this place that we now call Australia. When people learn about Australia, they learn that it was, people say it was built off the sheep's back. And really, when the English came here more than 200 years ago, they came here to utilize these lands and to take everything that they possibly could from them. And a lot of that has been to do with establishing agriculture and agricultural exports. So I'm going to give you an example. That meant chopping up all of the land and giving it to people that were called settlers, which were unfortunately really in real terms invaders, but we still don't speak properly about what happened on these lands. our people were forcibly displaced and many, many massacres happened as people put up fences for their sheep runs and for their crops. And our people tried to traverse their own cultural landscapes that had been theirs for tens of thousands of years. They were shot at, they were slaughtered, many terrible things happened. And colonization is all about taking the lands from those who are the sovereign owners of that land and using it for that those people that have come in's benefit and wealth production. So, for example, on my country now, there are many, many different agricultural crops grown that are extremely damaging and they are completely destroying our cultural landscape. So at the moment in Australia, the number one industry in agriculture is almonds. Almonds make more money than any other agriculture that we are currently practicing here. But like all agriculture in Australia, so many of the plants being grown are not plants that are favourable to these landscapes and our ongoing resources. So things like cotton, rice, almonds, they were never grown by our people. They're not part of what this country and this cultural landscape can sustain. They use incredible amounts of water. They cause erosion. Basically, everything that we're growing here has been imported from somewhere else, and it's causing a lot of harm. And more farmers are finding that the ways that they've been farming, using a lot of chemicals, using far too much water, because they're producing crops that fundamentally are not the right crops for this place. So on my country, almonds are being grown at an alarming rate. It's one of the biggest crops and they have to be grown near waterways because they use four times more water than most other crops. So wheat, for example, almonds use four times more water. Then because they don't really belong on these lands, they're very prone to getting disease, and so they are absolutely bombed with pesticides. So then you've got the problem of lots and lots of chemicals being used for them to produce and make enough money for people. And then because they're grown along waterways, because they have to rip so much water to be able to produce, those chemicals that they're bombed with then go into our waterways. The next big problem is that they need more bees than any other crop to be pollinated. And so bees are sent in, and it's been likened to sending bees to war. Very few of the bees come back out because they get killed by the pesticides. When you grow things that don't belong on country, like almonds, they're also grown as a monoculture. So just all on their own. All other plants around them are completely killed by them being there. So monocultures are also really bad for our landscapes, because insects and all animals need a diversity in order for biodiversity to be empowered and to be healthy. So no one's doing anything about the almond industry because it's making so much money. And the almond lobby is very, very powerful because they make so much money for the government as the number one agricultural export. So people don't even know what's actually really going on and how much harm is being caused to country. But on my Barkindji country, our Darling River, which we call the Barker, and we're Barkindji, so Barker is part of our actual name of our people, and Kindji is like people belonging to the Barker. Pretty soon, it seems very likely, with all of the fish kills and the terrible things that have happened on our country, where millions of fish have floated to the surface in many, many different catastrophic events over the last 10 years, because so much oxygen has been ripped from the water because of a series of interventions that are happening upstream, where people are taking so much water out of our Barker, our Darling River, that then it becomes really dry, algae starts to produce. So our people can't even drink or swim in the water anymore. We can't fish. Our waterway has become an absolute toxic mess. And most of the problem, as far as I can see from research that's been done and what our elders are telling us, is that agriculture and those incursions onto our lands have happened in a way that has not in any way respected the ways that we have cared for that waterway. It's important to its importance to us as a lifeblood, And we are being destroyed by the fact that our lifeblood is being destroyed. So every part of our culture relies on that waterway and that lifeblood. And agriculture is being championed, empowered, and our calls for that waterway to be looked after are being completely ignored. And because of colonization, we don't really get a say on what's happening in government, because we are only 3% of the population, and we don't have enough people helping us to amplify our voices. And so often we get consultants coming out to our country who talk to people, and then they go back to government and do exactly the same thing. Because when you consult with people, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to empower what they want. It just means you're sitting and listening and going away and doing whatever you want. Our real power to look after our country, which is part of our culture and part of our responsibility as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples across these lands, the power to be able to look after our landscapes has been taken from us. And that is a huge part of why our health and well-being continues to suffer.
And we've just been listening to a conversation about Indigenous food sovereignty in so-called Australia. This conversation took place between Wednesday Breakfast presenter Zoe and Zena Compston, who is a Barkanji woman. We will play the second part of that conversation next week, so do tune in for that. But you can also listen to this conversation on the episode of Accent of Women, dated the 26th of March.
And we haven't got time for any songs today, because we're going straight into an interview now with David Gland, an activist from the Refugee Action Collective. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, David.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Now, the reason that we've asked you to be here is because we're coming up to Palm Sunday, and I wondered what you guys were up to for that usual day of action.
Yeah, well, Palm Sunday this year, there'll be two options and two opportunities to come out onto the streets with refugees and for refugee rights. The Refugee Action Collective is working with the organisers of the Palestine Rally. And on that Sunday the 13th of April, there will be a refugee speaker and a Refugee Action Collective speaker on the platform at the Palestine Rally. So I think, as people know by now, those rallies take place at the State Library at 12 o'clock. And with our comrades from the Palestine movement, we'll be highlighting the demands of refugees, which are primarily for permanent visas. There are 7,000 or 8,000 people who have been left in limbo for something like 12 years now by the so-called fast-track process. There are refugees who we protested for outside the Mantra Hotel and the Park Hotel some years ago, who were brought here from Manus Island and Nauru under the Medivac process. They are still living in limbo. People have probably forgotten about some of these people, but they are living on recurring six-month bridging visas, which means theoretically they can be deported pretty much at any time. So we'll be calling, they'll be calling for permanent visas, and we'll also be calling on the Labor government to cancel legislation it passed late last year, which makes it much, much easier to deport people from this country. And some researchers have said up to 80,000 people, refugees, asylum.
Sorry, 80,000?
80,000 people are potentially able to be deported under this new legislation. So there's a lot to be angry about. There have been people living in limbo for 12 years or more, raising children, going to school, trying to contribute to society, and without permanent visas. And we're angry that Labor has done nothing over the last 3 years to deal with those particular problems. And we will be out on the streets to make it clear to the next government that we will fight them to deliver permanent visas for the people who so desperately need them. So your first chance for that message is State Library at 12 o'clock on the 13th. And then there is a program of activities being organised by the Refugee Advocacy Network, They're going to be on the Prince's Bridge near Flinders Street Station at 1 o'clock that day with banners and placards, and then heading down to what's known as Tom's Block, which is part of the gardens on St Kilda Road opposite the Victorian College of the Arts. And they'll be having music and speakers down there. So you can join one or both, as Refugee Action Collective will certainly be there at the State Library at 12 o'clock with our Palestinian brothers and sisters. And if for some reason you're not free on that day, or if you want to join more actions, the Refugee Action Collective has an action on this coming Saturday. That's the 5th of April at 5 o'clock in Brunswick, a slightly sort of different sort of time. Mm-hmm. And we'll be gathering at the very new park called Michel Guglielmo Park on Sydney Road. It's pretty much opposite the Brunswick Town Hall, and that's at 5 o'clock. And we'll have six amazing speakers, all women.
Just about to say, all women as well, by the looks of things, which is great.
All women, Tanmati Verma, Rafi Basroti, Atena Kashani, Katarina Sinani from the United Workers Union, and then Sam Ratnam, who's the Greens candidate for Wills, and Sue Bolton, who's the Socialist Alliance candidate. So we will be taking that message for permanent visas, to end the deportation laws, for justice for refugees, into the heart of Brunswick, which is in the seat of Wills, one of the seats which potentially could change hands in the next election. So you can join us on Saturday at 5 o'clock opposite the Brunswick Town Hall.
And just to go back to what you were saying at the start, in terms of the laws that were brought in last year, we covered them quite a bit at the time, but could you just run over what some of the key points of the laws were that were brought in last year that could lead to the deportation of 80,000? I did not realise it was as many as that people, if enforced.
Yeah, I mean, right now we don't seriously expect 80,000 people to be deported. But, of course, a Dutton government might decide to ramp up deportations, given what's happening around the world and the way that the racist right and the far right are focusing on deportation. Mm. The reason so many people are at risk is that, among other things, refugees whose applications fail can be sent back now to countries where they would be put at risk, or they can be sent to third countries, as Australia has done with sending refugees to Nauru. There's an attempt, essentially, to get around a high court ruling that people cannot be kept in indefinite detention. So they've changed the law to say, OK, we won't keep you in indefinite detention pending a deportation that can't happen. We'll change the rules to make it easier to deport you so we can actually get you out of the country. So, for instance, Iranian refugees who right now cannot be deported to Iran because they would be in danger could potentially be sent back to that country under the new deportation laws from December last year.
And just to reiterate, that's completely against the international commitments that we've made when in signing the 1951 Refugee Convention.
Yeah, absolutely. Under that convention, there's something called the refoulement obligation, which means you cannot send a refugee or an asylum seeker back to danger, even if their application for residency here has failed. And there are a number of countries where it is extremely dangerous for refugees to be sent back. Iran, Sudan, Afghanistan. After all, these people have fled from danger in the first place. Their terrible experience didn't begin when they were rounded up by border force and locked away by the Australian government. It began many years before. And the Australian government is basically threatening people, saying, if you don't agree to go back voluntarily, we will send you either back to your own country where you may be in danger or to a third country. So they're basically standing over people and threatening them to try to get them to leave Australia. And these are people who have run from danger, and they deserve our solidarity and our protection.
And because we've got the election coming up, can you just run through what your demands are of candidates in the upcoming federal election?
Yeah, First and foremost, it's permanent visas for those who are trapped in the fast-track system. The Liberal government brought in a process basically setting up refugees to fail, where they were given the briefest opportunity to put their case, often without the opportunity to bring together supporting witnesses or paperwork or the like, and then they were failed. And they've been on bridging visas, technically pending deportation, for 12 years or more. Now, the Labor government did abolish the fast-track process in the last 3 years, and you'd think then the logic is they would then give at least a second opportunity to state their case to refugees who failed. They've refused to do that. And you've got a tiny, tiny number of individuals who have managed to fight their way through the system, but something like 7,000 people are still trapped in this limbo, this hell, particularly Tamil refugees and Iranian refugees, but there are others. And so we're demanding of this government and the next government that they should give permanent protection to those refugees. And that should apply to the refugees brought here under the Medivac legislation. So refugees who were brought from Manus Island in Papua New Guinea and Nauru in order to get medical treatment in Australia. We fought as a movement and we won for them to be released from hotel detention, and they're living in the community, but they're still on rotating six-month visas. Mm. These are people who have contributed to Australian society. We're talking about artists and people who have set up businesses. But whether they've done that or not,
indeed,
these are people who have been damaged by the Australian system, and Australia owes them residency.
And so I'm pretty sure that the convention doesn't say that you have obligations only to, you know, people who are able to contribute to society. I think it's an obligation to all refugees, regardless of their ability to contribute or otherwise.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, our demand is on behalf of those people who have been damaged by the whole experience, including the Australian detention system. There are still a tiny number of people in Papua New Guinea, and many of them have been very badly psychologically damaged by Australia locking them up and throwing away the key. All of those people should be brought to Australia.
Now, I'm afraid that much as I'd like to hear, could you very briefly say if there are any other demands that you've got? We're running out of time, I'm afraid.
Well, the end of the deportation laws that were passed last year, they need to be rescinded as a matter of urgency. Mm-hmm. There are gunning at the heads of thousands and thousands of refugees and asylum seekers. So I think we're also raising the concern that there are something like 14,000 refugees trapped in Indonesia because Australia won't even consider their applications for residency. So we're asking for Australia to lift the restriction on those refugees seeking asylum in Australia. So that would be another demand.
And let's just remind listeners that the countries which have the largest numbers of refugees tend to be poorer countries in the global south, and the global north in general takes a lot fewer refugees than countries that are bordering areas of conflict or areas.
Absolutely. And it's not just that they're poor. Many of those countries are victims of wars which have been started by imperialist powers, including by Australia.
Indeed. Well, I'm sorry to have to cut you off, but we will put links to at least the April 5th event in our show notes today. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, David.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
That was David Glanz from the Refugee Action Collective talking about both the Palm Sunday rally on the 13th of April and also the upcoming rally on the 5th of Saturday, this coming Saturday at 5 p.m. A welcome refugee, scrap the deportation laws, permanent visa now rally opposite the Brunswick Town Hall. Shall we go straight into community announcements? Have we got anything lined up today?
Yeah, there's other than the event that David was just speaking about now on Saturday, I couldn't find a whole lot more, except on Sunday, there's a Rents Due event at the Black Spark Center. So that's a fundraiser for Black Spark, and I'm sure many listeners would have gone along to an event at Black Spark at some point. They host many amazing things and are a huge pillar of organizing and hosting events. And so that's from 3 to 9 p.m. this Sunday, and it's a fundraiser to help pay the rent at Black Spark. They're going to have music and raffles and workshops and food and books and all sorts of things. So, if you can get along and help pay for the rent at Black Spark that hosts so much great events and things for everyone.
There's also a talk tonight, a webinar, Gaza, a Microcosm of Palestine, a conversation with Dr. Yara Hawari. That I'm trying to find where you can get. It's being organized with the Palestine Justice Movement. And I've got a QR code, but I don't have a website for where you can get it. But I think if you go to the Palestine Justice, let me have a quick, if you look for the Palestine Justice Movement Sydney, which is on Facebook, you can get the details there. So that's tonight at 7 o'clock, but you do need to register to be able to attend.
And of course there's the Palestine rallies have now returned to weekly, so
unfortunately
we can now recommend heading along to those every week again. And the smoking ceremony and other events at the Camp Sovereignty, of course, are happening weekly from 2:30 at so-called King's Domain near the Sydney Meyer Music Bowl. It's an amazing space to go along and chat with comrades from different parts of organizing across NAM, and a beautiful space to connect with First Nations justice and liberation.
On Saturday, the 5th of April, there's also an event in the city at the State Library at 1 p.m. this Saturday, organized by the Campaign Against Racism, Fascism and Racism, CARF. And the protest is called Stop Trump, Fight the Far Right. That'll be this Saturday at 1 p.m. at the State Library of Victoria. And you can find this on the Green Left weekly calendar.
And I think that's probably all we've got time for today. So today on the show we had, most recently, David Glanz, activist with the Refugee Action Collective. Before that,
previous to that, we spoke to Zina Cumpston about Indigenous food sovereignty in so-called Australia.
And before that, we spoke and continued the conversation with Sasha Gillies-Lakakis, co-host of Latin American Update and Unitarian Half Hour here on 3CR. And we continued that conversation regarding Cuba and the socialist revolution there, drawing the long history and background. And before that one, we spoke with Lily, we had a clip from Jan Bartlett's Tuesday Home Time program, where Jan spoke with Lily, who is a member of the Alawite community here in Melbourne, NAM, and where Lily was talking about their experience as a member of the Alawite community here and the situation for Alawites and other minorities currently in Syria. And that's it. That's all we have time for. Really appreciate everyone coming along to listen and tune in. Maybe you're listening on your radio in the car, or maybe you have an old-style radio somewhere at home, or you're listening through the community radio app, which you can download onto your phone, or you can listen through the website, or there's a playback service if you're listening in the future. I hope the future is going really well. And my name's Jesse, and you're here with co-host Sonia and Nita. And stick around for Stick Together, which is our only national radio show focusing on industrial, social, and workplace issues. And stay tuned to 3CR Radio.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.